VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and we thank you for being with us in this bumper week of European finals. Now, with us in the studio is a former Nottingham Forest fullback. Nottingham Forest, of course, winners of 2 European Cups. Although, Gregor, I don't think you made the team that day.
No, not in my time, I'm afraid.
And, of course, he's also a columnist for The Times, Gregor Robertson. We also have one of the true connoisseurs of the European game, Mr. James Gearbrand. And best of all, the star of the show, joining us as he prepares to embark on his 12-hour odyssey to Baku, it's Ollie Kay.
Let's start then with the biggest game in European club football, the Champions League final, taking place on Saturday night between Liverpool and Tottenham in Madrid. We're joined now on the phone by Paul Joyce. And Paul, by the time the Champions League final comes around, it will have been 3 weeks since Liverpool and Spurs took part in a competitive match. Is it fair to say that's not ideal?
Yes, not ideal, I don't think. I think Jurgen Klopp's found the sort of delay in the between the last game of the season and this final a bit irritating. I think Liverpool tried to organise a game on Saturday in the Marbella training camp, but because a lot of the other leagues had already finished, the quality and range of opposition was severely limited. So I think they ended up playing a Benfica B side, stroke under 23 side, and it was just sort of wasn't really even 45 minutes each half. It was a trimmed down version of that. So no, I don't think it's ideal, the length of time, but at the same time, you know, we just need to get on with it, really.
Obviously, we're taping this. I'm going to give away a secret here. We're taping this on a Monday. The one positive of this longer break is that there might be some injured players or players who had already come back, but maybe you weren't sure if they could start. Thinking of Oxlade-Chamberlain, yeah. Maybe. Can you just give us an update as you understand it? And nobody's going to hold you to account here and say, Joyce, he's thick, he doesn't know anything about Liverpool, because you are talking to us on a Monday and a lot can happen between now and Saturday. But on the lineup, any new people who might be available, and anybody who you think might make it into the starting 11, specifically, I guess, in midfield and at the back?
No, I think the key one for Liverpool has been around the fitness of Firmino. Obviously missed the end of the season with an adductor problem. He reported to Spain earlier than the rest of the team with his own personal physio from the club and was doing some stuff out there. So I think he won't have played since the Barcelona first leg, and even then he only came on for the final 15 minutes, I think. So I think he would be the one that Klopp needs to check on this week. Otherwise, I think Liverpool team's fairly settled. I think that the choice that he's got is probably Milner or Wijnaldum in midfield. I feel he might go Wijnaldum to start the game. But really, that's the only headache that Klopp has got.
There's a choice of Wijnaldum and Milner. I presume Henderson and Fabinho are going to be the other two central midfielders.
Yeah.
Should he feel that Firmino's not ready or whatever? Are we looking at Origi?
I would think so, but then he obviously played Wijnaldum in that advanced role in the first leg at the Camp Nou. He has got options. Shaqiri could be an option. Oxlade-Chamberlain, Lallana. But you would think sort of Origi with his goals in the semi-final second leg could benefit from there. I mean, hopefully Firmino's fit from Klopp's point of view. It's just that I think he would, having not played since that Barcelona first leg, I think he will be the one that has been on his mind in the build-up to this game. I think the rest of the positions are fairly set. The defence will be set Firmino was fit, he takes his place in the front three, and then, as we said, the sort of midfield, Milner or Wijnaldum, really.
What about Tottenham then? There's always been a few questions over whether or not Harry Kane's rushed back from previous injuries, but Gregor, knowing how important this is for Harry Kane to be fit, you'd expect him to take part if he comes through all the tests that are necessary?
Yeah, I mean, he's their talisman. Top goal scorer, he's the one that I think he's going to play, if fit. Obviously, people have stepped up, particularly Son and Moura, when they've had to, when he's been injured during the season. But I think if he's fit, he's going to play.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think if he's fit, there's no real kind of debate that if Harry Kane's fit, he'll play. And, you know, maybe if he's kind of 90% fit, then he'll probably start as well. What I would say is I think the absolute worst thing that Tottenham possibly could do, and as we've mentioned, there's been quite a long break leading up to the Champions League final, so he's had a lot of recovery time and, you know, maybe he will be completely fully fit. But I think the worst thing Tottenham could do would be to start a 60% not really fit Harry Kane. I think throughout the season, we've seen that this is actually a very resilient team that is more than capable of playing very well without Harry Kane, maybe with the exception of the last month of the Premier League campaign when everyone was knackered and they were probably prioritising the Champions League anyway. But if you kind of look at all the stats, the team in Kane's absence, if you look at how they played against Ajax in the Champions League semi-final when they absolutely deserved to win that tie based on expected goals and chances created and everything like that, and generated a ton of attack against a good team. This is a team that is not massively diminished by not having Harry Kane, apart from maybe in the sort of talisman sense. But then actually, not having someone like Kane can psychologically be quite galvanising sometimes because everyone kind of steps up in his absence. But obviously, if he is fit, there's no debate.
Joycey, painting very broad brushstrokes, hopefully you'd agree that of the two managers, Pochettino's the one who's more likely to do something tactical, change a formation, approach things differently. And we saw a little bit of that from Klopp, for example, in the first leg against Barcelona when he started Gomez or and obviously played Wijnaldum further up. But generally speaking, would it be fair to say that Klopp is more likely to go out the best 11, play the way he plays, and Pochettino's the one who's going to maybe worry more about the opposition, maybe make an adjustment to try and find an edge?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think Klopp's, you know, I'd be surprised if he, well, I just don't think he'll deviate from 4-3-3. I think in the games Liverpool and Tottenham have had recently, there's always been sort of spells where Liverpool have been on top and haven't really translated dominance into goals. And then Pochettino's been very clever and changed something within those games, and Tottenham have sort of wrestled back the initiative and looked stronger at times. The last game at Anfield recently, they probably should have won that game. You know, there was a Sissoko chance when he was through on goal, and it was Van Dijk was covering Sissoko and Son. I think Pochettino is very good at influencing it from the sidelines. I think Klopp doesn't get enough credit for that as well. I think he's shown this season that he, you know, there was a lot of doubt at the start of the season about the departure of Buvac from his backroom staff, you know, the man called the Brain, and he'd been with him for 17 years, and that without him, Klopp was going to be bereft. And I think Klopp's shown this season that he's more than just somebody who fist pumps and smiles and bear hugs. I think he's probably enjoyed being able to coach again a little bit more than maybe he did when Buvac was there.
Let's talk a little bit more about Liverpool and their fullbacks. Trent Alexander-Arnold, what, only Eden Hazard and Ryan Fraser had more Premier League assists. Then you've got, Gregor, your namesake, Andy Robertson as well. What do you make of Liverpool's fullbacks, and how on earth do Spurs stop them?
Well, first of all, they've been incredible this season. I don't think there are many English footballers who are kind of as technically complete as Trent Alexander-Arnold. I think, you know, the way he strikes a ball, his assists, his crossing, he's remarkable. And you know, people spoke earlier when he first broke through about the possibility of him playing in midfield at some point. I'm sure he could. But fullback's now a position where you can influence the game just as much, and he's doing that. Another side, Robertson is just a bundle of energy, tenacious. He kind of, you know, that moment against Barcelona, which sort of when he ruffled Messi's hair, it just kind of, that sums him up. He's a force of nature, so, and he sort of represents what Klopp wants in his team, I think, on the pitch. So they've been incredible. How to stop them is a difficult one. I think really it'll depend how Tottenham set up, as Gab was alluding to there, how they look to counter that threat, maybe how they, where Rose and Trippier play, whether they play a little bit higher up or not.
Would a way, I mean, I just, from your position having played as a fullback, because I'm not saying he's going to do this because it might be too attacking or whatever, but we've seen him play 4-3-3 with Eriksen and Ali in midfield out of necessity, right? So presume it's a final, might be more conservative. But if he did line up with Son and Lucas Moura wide and Harry Kane central, wouldn't that naturally pin these fullbacks back? I mean, it's hard to see them attacking the way they do if you know that you've got those two guys behind you. Do you think that's something that...
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that earlier.
And maybe Harry Kane dropping off.
Yeah. I mean, it depends who's in the ascendancy and who starts the game better and that kind of thing. Because at the end of the day, they're going to have to defend with them. They're going to have to track them back. That's the way it is these days. You can't have someone just stand high and wide and hope that the fullbacks don't attack.
No, but, I mean, work rate isn't really a problem with Son. But... Just use a fullback. If you knew you're playing against a team that has a winger and you're supposed to attack, even if he doesn't track you, the idea that if one of your teammates loses a ball and it's a quick out and then all of a sudden, you know, you're caught up the pitch and he's on the shoulder and running at your big, slow central defender, that does plant a seed in your mind, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. That's a possibility. That certainly would seem to be... and a more attacking approach than if you just played two fullbacks and hoped that was going to...
It puts a lot of strain on the midfield if he does that. And you're asking Ali to go and help out with the holding midfielder, who I would assume would be Sissoko, right? Because Pochettino does occasionally throw you curveballs that you don't expect.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think we saw during the Liverpool second leg against Barcelona, I think one of the real key features of that game on the Barcelona side was obviously that they didn't have Ousmane Dembele. And that, for me, was a player that they massively missed, because you just didn't have any kind of...
pace.
You didn't have that threat of pace on the counter. And so that, to me, is why, I guess, Son is probably a more guaranteed starter than Lucas in this final. And I think Son is absolutely key, because he's got that pace. Assuming that he plays kind of on or from the left, we know that Klopp must have, to some extent, some concerns about Trent Alexander-Arnold as a kind of defensive player. That presumably is why he played Joe Gomez at right back in the new camp. So I think, obviously, you would imagine he's going to play Alexander-Arnold in the final. So for me, Son versus Alexander-Arnold could be an absolutely key battle in this match.
Well, what we do know is that both managers come into this final having not won a trophy with either Tottenham or Liverpool, respectively.
Or so, anybody ever, in Pochettino's case, as his enemies love to remind us.
Indeed, but Gab, someone is going to break their duck then.
Yeah, and look, as you know, I'm in Camp Poch on this one. Like, you know, trophies are for egos. That's not how you judge a manager's work. And I know people are going to come out of the woodwork and say, you know, the usual Neanderthal points, but I think it's true. Obviously, it's nice to win a trophy. It's important to win a trophy. Obviously, this would be Tottenham's biggest trophy since they did the double in 1961. And in fact, if you're of a more European bent, you might say this is actually bigger than the double that they won in 1961. Yeah, it does move the needle and it does generate excitement, and it's important for the club commercially and whatever. There is that weird story about, you know, the whole Pochettino, I might leave angle to it as well, which I find absolutely fascinating. And if Pochettino wins the European Cup and he says, okay, my work here is done, time for a new challenge, I can't take the club any further than winning the biggest trophy in club sport in the world. I just wonder, I mean, do we believe that this is even a possibility? Or?
But isn't that going against what he was saying about trophies are for ego? Surely there is more to do. If you win the Champions League, surely you think, this is where I'm going to start and kick on.
I mean, look, I honestly don't know what he's going to do, and I completely agree with you. But he's already made them into a team that can challenge for the Premier League title. He's done that already, right? They challenged Leicester for the Premier League title and came up short. There's a reality there, I think, with some of the contracts of some of the players, like Christian Eriksen, like Alderweireld. There's a reality there that Manchester City and Liverpool are in another stratosphere right now in terms of resources that Manchester United can be. I don't know. Would you be tempted, if you win this, would you be tempted to move on, Gilbert, if you were Poch?
Well, I think, I guess the other kind of aspect to this is the sort of the landscape of the kind of big jobs in Europe. And from that point of view, I'm not sure what the obvious opening for Poch is. Obviously, Barcelona is one that seems like it may become available.
But not going to happen.
He's repeatedly said that he won't do that because of his Espanyol loyalties. Tuchel has just extended at PSG. I guess Bayern isn't a completely open and shut case, but you would imagine that them winning the cup makes it more likely that Kovac will stay. Juve, I guess, is a possibility that could be.
I think Juve is the obvious one.
Could be in play.
Or even Bayern, even with Kovac winning the trophy. I think if Bayern see a better option, which you would have to consider Pochettino to be, they may be pushing this. Look, and it might be that it's something Pochettino does to get more leverage, more assurances from Levy. We have seen him do this before. And look, please, Spurs fans, please don't have a go at us like when he was being linked with United. Like, he's really good. I'm going by what he said. It would be great to see him back. But it is true that even with the new stadium, I think Tottenham's job just keeps getting more and more difficult every year.
I think the deciding factor more than whether he wins this trophy or not is what investment he gets in the summer. I think, you know, it can't go on like it has in the last two windows, or even close to it. So I think he's going to need investment, and I think the club know that, so they'd be mad not to.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. So that is the second European final featuring two English clubs this week. Let's move on to the first. Arsenal take on Chelsea in the Europa League final. Unai Emery looking for his fourth Europa League title and a chance to take the Gunners into the Champions League. Maurizio Sarri is aiming to win his first trophy in management. Well, Ollie Kay joins us now. And Ollie, a busy week for you coming up.
It's already started as we speak. I'm at Heathrow, having left at home up north at 4:30 this morning, Manchester, then Heathrow, and then Istanbul, and then Baku, and I get to Baku very late tonight. It's a hell of a long way, isn't it, Baku? I've forgotten just how far it is. It's sort of 6-hour flights normally, but going via Istanbul, it's obviously taking a bit longer. And having been able to book before the semi-finals were decided, and not had to wait until the second legs were done, it does bring it home how difficult it is for fans to get there, and how expensive it is, and how much time there are people who are going back via Bahrain and via Doha and stuff like that. It's so difficult a place to get to, and you just wonder, apart from everything else that we've spoken about previously with Mkhitaryan and so on, but even on the most basic level, it's such a difficult place to get to with flights in and out, with airport capacity, with hotel capacity to some extent, that it's not really surprising that there are going to be a lot of tickets returned, both from sponsors and indeed from the clubs. I mean, there was people were up in arms about how few tickets there were made available for two clubs. I think they're going to be Chelsea going to return tickets because they haven't been able to sell them, just because of the sheer difficulty of getting here. And it's all the things we talked about before about the choice of venue. I don't think this is an experience that too many people are going to be looking back on with a great sense of a job well done by UEFA. I'm absolutely not saying that the location makes it impossible to have it there, because you know it's as far up from Britain as you can get in Europe, but that's not a problem, because the British Isles is an outpost anyway, so we shouldn't be thinking, well, you can't have final there because it's 6 hours flight from Britain. But it's just stupid to have people going so far, and if it's stupid to have journalists going so far and chalking up so many air miles and you know carbon footprints and so on. It is stupid, and I totally agree with the piece that James wrote on the Times website last week, where he suggested that the perfect solution is to revert to the old-fashioned UEFA Cup model, where they had two-legged finals, one home, one away. I mean, people said, well, that's not great for the away fans. Well, if they win it in the second leg and there are 2,000 there to see it, well, that's all there are going to be of Chelsea on Wednesday night.
The build-up has been mired in controversy around the venue of Baku, as Ollie has said, and much of it surrounding Henrik Mkhitaryan as well. Gab, for those that aren't familiar with the political background, what's going on here?
So Mkhitaryan, of course, is from Armenia, where he's a national hero. There's an area sort of along the border between the two countries. I remember growing up, I heard it referred to as the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, where I think it's an Armenian enclave politically in Azerbaijan. A lot of this has to do with what happened when the Soviet Union broke up, because a lot of these states were just basically lines drawn on a map without too much regard, and that's why you get these tensions. Technically, I think the two countries are still at war. There have been mass evacuations. It's been a very bloody conflict. Mkhitaryan feels that he would not be safe in Azerbaijan because he's Armenian. The Azerbaijani government and the Azerbaijani FA and UEFA have said, no, look, you're safe. Other Armenian athletes have come to compete in Azerbaijan. This isn't about politics. This is about sport. For whatever reason, and there may be reasons beyond that. I mean, like, if he doesn't feel safe, he doesn't feel safe. But you wonder if maybe there aren't issues also possibly to do with insurance, possibly to do with other factors, to do with the reaction back home in Armenia as well. You know, people maybe not wanting him to play there. It's just a lot for somebody to worry about. You can ask, why play the final in Azerbaijan if that's the case? Probably would be a similar situation if they played the final in Armenia and there were Azeris playing there. This is going to become a political football, has become a political football, and that's a downside. It should, like I said, he didn't play when they played, was it Karabakh they played, yeah. James? You know, he didn't play then either. These are personal decisions that people make and have to do what they're comfortable with.
You also missed a game when he played for Borussia Dortmund as well, when they played in Azerbaijan. Yeah.
I think they're part of, I think, people's frustration with it is, this was actually eminently predictable. Arsenal were among the favourites to get to the Europa League final since the start of the competition. Henrik Mkhitaryan has been, you know, he's not emerged out of nowhere this season. He's been a prominent player in European football for a while. I think one of the things that's kind of missing in this story is that the Azerbaijani authorities say that they did provide safety guarantees, which obviously were not deemed sufficient by Mkhitaryan and Arsenal. So it'd be interesting to kind of know exactly what was sought and you know what they came back with. And I think one of the other things that maybe we miss in all this is, in England, the Europa League is not a huge thing, and hence the Europa League final is not a huge thing. But from the perspective of Mkhitaryan, this is probably the biggest game in his career. one of, if not the single biggest game in his career. You know, we can have that semantic argument about whether it's a case of can't play or won't play, but this is Armenia's biggest sports star in the potentially, the, you know, arguably the biggest game of his career, and he is in a very, very difficult situation.
And I think we should point out that, you know, last year the Champions League final was in Kiev, in Ukraine. We could have easily had a situation there as well where a Russian club or even just a Russian player at a top level reaches the final. I think these are the tricky things that you have to navigate as an organization, because you can also make the point and say, all right, so, okay, so you countries that we deem to be security risks for certain individuals, a very small minority of individuals who actually play professional football in a very small minority of clubs, you guys don't get to host competitions, right? I mean, that would be the counter argument to it.
We obviously know that there is difficulty in fans getting to the game, as well as this Mkhitaryan issue. Some have suggested that the two clubs should have boycotted this game. Gregor, do you think that would have been the right solution?
When the news first broke, it was tempting to think that way, but I think, as the guys have articulated, there's enough sort of issues around this and kind of complications. It's not straightforward, you know. It's ultimately Mkhitaryan's taken this decision himself with valid reasons. I think really it all comes back to Azerbaijan being granted the final in the first place. I think if Gab's right in saying that they're at war with another, it's probably
technically. I don't think the armistice hasn't been.
That's a good place to start. I think that's probably a good clue to not hand a country away.
What I would say about that, though, is that, you know, not that long ago in the 80s and 90s, you could have, depending to what degree you stretch a definition of at war, right? So Nagorno-Karabakh is the opposite end of Azerbaijan. You could have made the same point, well, surely we can't have anything at Wembley because there's war in Northern Ireland, right? And there's troubles and there's people blowing things up. So,
might have been a valid point.
Right. you think so?
I think so, yeah. I think if there's possibly a threat, then you don't host a final there. It's about people's safety, players and fans, really.
Yeah, the whole thing, unfortunately, gets completely politicized, right? I mean, imagine the Azerbaijani Minister for Tourism, you know, popping up and saying, like, these are the crime statistics in Azerbaijan. These are the crime statistics in London with knives and terrorists and whatever. And look, we are much safer, so, you know, you English people get off your high horse, and then you don't know where the truth is, what the logic is. You know, I just think where there are minimum security guarantees in place, and there are in Azerbaijan, you just have to respect individual decisions of people who don't feel that they're comfortable to be there and say, you know, I'm sorry. I mean, to me, the Peter Cech angle to the story.
Well, that's what I wanted to come on to next.
It's equally remarkable.
Mm. So, Peter Cech, he has been Arsenal's Europa League goalkeeper. He's retiring after this match, and reports suggest he'll then be joining Chelsea in a sporting director-type role. So, Gab, you're intrigued by it. Do you start Peter Cech?
Well, it's funny. We had a very similar situation in Serie A at the end of last season, and this was with a player where De Vrij, who was at Lazio at the time, the Dutch defender, he was out of contract, and news emerged that he'd agreed to join Inter Milan the following season on a Bosman. And then they were playing Lazio on the last day of the season for a place in the Champions League, effectively. So, you know, the question is, what do you do with those situations?
And he made a sort of terrible error, didn't he, in that game?
Yeah, that's the way it was depicted. I mean, he also came very close to scoring as well. So, you know, and I don't think anybody's doubting his integrity, but the idea is, do you put somebody in that position? Now, it's even more extreme, I think there than Peter Cech. What I'm really surprised at this is, I don't know, we get all high and mighty and tapping up and whatever. I got to know Peter Cech the tiny bit. I think he's a phenomenal pro and a phenomenal person. But this is really, really bad judgment on his part to speak to them. I mean, assuming he has while he's still under contract. While he knows that, you know, forget the Europa League final, but they're going head-to-head with Chelsea for a spot in the Champions League, let's not forget. So unless he somehow knew that, unless Emery had told them, you know, in a squeaky voice that, look, you know, you're not going to play again the rest of the season, or he sought permission from Arsenal, which he may have done, and that would be a classy thing to do. I hope he did that, because otherwise he's really putting himself in a really unpleasant position.
So would you start him?
No, I'd start Leno. Okay. I don't think it would be fair to anybody if Cech makes mistakes. I think Leno's, well, Gierbrandt's going to tell us that Leno's a better goalkeeper. What? Right? And he is, yeah?
Yeah.
I think Leno has been really good this season.
And Emery obviously thinks he's a better goalkeeper. So I think, you know, as I said, unless Peter Cech went and, you know, spoke to Raul Sanyehi and said, hey, look, I'm retiring. Chelsea might be offering me a job. Is it cool with you if I go talk to them? And if Arsenal say fine, then that's different. Mm-hmm. If he simply did this without alerting Arsenal, then I think Arsenal are more than entitled to say, sorry, Peter, you're not playing in this game.
Gregor, what do you think?
I agree. I think if you're to ask Peter Cech, we all know what the answer is. He wants to play in his last game, and he'll say that it's not going to affect him. He's been in some pretty big pressure games and situations before. But it's going to add a little bit of pressure, a little bit of kind of needle to the game. So it's ultimately Emery's decision, and I think the safest one is to start Leno, yeah.
It's kind of an interesting debate anyway, the whole issue of whether you should, if you have a cup goalkeeper and a league goalkeeper, whether you should just chuck your cup goalkeeper when you get to a big final. And we actually know, because obviously Emery has a long history in this competition, that Emery doesn't do that in general. I think when he coached Sevilla to 3 consecutive Europa League titles, and I think David Soria was the cup goalkeeper, and I think Sergio Rico was the league goalkeeper, and Soria played in the finals. People say, you know, well, it's, you know, it's a huge match, why wouldn't you start your best goalkeeper? And I've always been kind of slightly sympathetic to the idea that you should show your cup goalkeeper a little bit of loyalty, because if you want to have 2 decent goalkeepers, if you want to have, you know, if you want, as a club, you want to attract a high quality backup goalkeeper, obviously you need to sort of offer them certain assurances that they're actually going to play in meaningful games. And I think if you don't give a, you know, your second choice goalkeeper the rewards of, you know, having played an entire tournament, then playing in the final, it sort of diminishes the offer that you can make when you're sort of recruiting a backup goalkeeper.
Although this backup goalkeeper is retiring from football, so yeah, you could take a bit more liberties with
that. Of course. I mean, and yeah, like, you know, exactly. Emery could just say, well, you know, he's not going to be part of the club next season, so, you know, he could just be completely Machiavellian about it and pick. I mean, of course, he could do that. I thought it was kind of interesting as well, Emery's press conference before this. I think they're doing another one, but he did one last week at the Arsenal training ground. And he was really kind of animated and impassioned on the subject of Petr Cech, much more so than he was about the subject of Henrik Mkhitaryan not being, you know, not playing in this final, going on about he's such a great guy, you know, he's such an amazing person, you know, do you know he can speak Russian? I didn't know that. Wow, what a cool guy. He plays the drums, amazing. Which, I mean, honestly, is like, it's the most impassioned Emery has been all season.
Yeah, seriously, no, I'm really shocked because Emery's press conferences are absolutely dire. He's one of the least pleasant people to listen to when he's in front of Mike. I mean, maybe he's good company at dinner, but so he went all out. He became fun, Unai.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you, James, because you've written a piece about Mesut Ozil in the Times. Who is he then? Because you've really got to know him, haven't you? Who is he? And will we see him on Wednesday night?
No, I think what's really interesting about Ozil and the kind of reason for writing the piece is when he won the World Cup 5 years ago in 2014, he was really kind of seen as the sort of the poster boy of a very multicultural German team, and there was a lot of kind of, you know, social significance attached to him. And obviously what's very interesting now in the sort of final stage of his career is that that kind of importance has materialised in a completely different way, because obviously last year he explosively withdrew himself from the German national team, making allegations of discrimination and essentially racial discrimination against the German Football Association, but kind of also more widely the media and, I guess, in general society itself. So it's kind of fascinating what Ozil's legacy will be and how he'll be remembered. And I think the kind of whole issue of his sort of his identity is incredibly complex. I mean, obviously the whole thing was started by him posing for photos with the authoritarian Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, which he has always been completely unrepentant about, and he has always maintained that this was simply him honouring the highest office of his ancestral homeland and was not kind of political endorsement of Erdogan. Just last week, however, he was pictured again with Erdogan in Istanbul and reportedly has even invited him to his wedding. I think most people would agree that the kind of scapegoating of him that happened after the World Cup was totally excessive, and that he was right and, you know, brave to kind of call attention to it. It's a really kind of complex issue, but I find him such a fascinating player. I think he remains very enigmatic. I have the impression that he's never really kind of been loved in England, although, and we sort of debate whether he's actually been a good player or, you know, whether he's kind of been ultimately a bit disappointing at Arsenal. I don't think he's ever really been loved like some of the other kind of foreign stars of the Premier League era.
It wasn't simply the fact that Erdogan was seen by, was an authoritarian leader. It was that at the time there was a dispute going on between Germany and Turkey, specifically over Germans who were eligible to vote in Turkish elections and their treatment and speeches that were given in Germany. And there was a lot of political tension between those two countries. And I got the sense that Ozil isn't a guy who speaks much and he's a guy who's apolitical and he has other interests. I mean, he's got a chain of coffee shops as well.
He sort of has his own kind of esports academy, basically, I think. You're right. I mean, he's not sort of...
He's enigmatic.
What's interesting about...
Weird. It's the same thing in Madrid, too, where you said, like, you know, in Madrid, he had... I'm going to get the number wrong, but something stupid, like 57 assists over 2 years. It's something absurd, right? Now, you could also make the point that, oh, yeah, that's fine. That Madrid team just passed the ball to Ronaldo. He scores, you know, any Muppet can get an assist. But it's still quite a feat. And yet, when he left Real Madrid, even though he left for a huge amount of money, nobody was sort of sad to see him go in terms of the media or whatever. It's this unusual sphere he inhabits where he should be a superstar, and he obviously has interests that go beyond football, but for some reason it just doesn't necessarily translate into commercial popularity. And I don't think it's simply because of the way he plays football, which inevitably divides opinion, with some people saying he's one of the top five players in the Premier League and others saying that he's lazy and whatever. And even Emery adding gasoline in the fire with his treatment of Ozil this season.
It is interesting what you were saying there, James, about him not perhaps being loved as one of the best Premier League imports. Gregor, is he misunderstood? Is he a better player than those that are suggesting he shouldn't be in the top five in the Premier League are saying?
Well, I'm assuming it's everybody doesn't think he's in the top five. in terms of ability, maybe, but yeah. Nobody's going to have Ozil in their top five in
not
the Premier
for me,
okay,
no.
Thank you.
It's a complicated one. I think the kind of the way the game's evolved as well, that, you know, there's very few players can be have any sort of inkling of being a sort of luxury at any moment, you know. It's all about the system and everyone has to press and put in so much effort essentially defensively as well. And that's where the question marks arise. Maybe it's the team he's in as well, and the system. He's not played in a hugely successful Arsenal team, has he? And the German team was a hugely successful team. So, I mean, that could be an aspect of it. And then there's obviously just his sort of the way he's perceived, the way he kind of carries himself on the pitch. And that's there are players that portray a certain image, and it's not kind of what fans, especially in English football. Roaring down and flying into tackles and that kind of, there's still an element of that in English football.
I think that's kind of what's so interesting about it, is it's not like, I think it's a hugely kind of nuanced case, because in some ways Ozil clearly has not been as effective a player as he might have been, and I don't think even his most ardent supporters would argue he is not the most, you know, he's not the most defensively kind of hard-working player. But also, as Gregor kind of alluded to, so much the way we talk about it is actually bound up in actually kind of really quite sort of ideas of national identity, that, you know, English football is all about, you know, kind of rolling your sleeves up and really getting stuck in. And there's, I think, you know, there's quite a similar perception in Germany, the sort of old school values of the sort of previous kind of West Germany tournament winning sides. They were hard working sides that would fight, you know, for every last ball. And that's just although Ozil has many qualities, those are not his qualities. His qualities are not what you might sort of call typically German sort of football qualities. I think he's such an interesting player, and I think there's so much nuance to the kind of perception of him both as a player and as a person. I think, you know, without being too kind of glib about it, I think, you know, there's right and wrong on both sides, basically.
We spoke about the future of one manager earlier on with Maurizio Pochettino. What about Maurizio Sarri, who spoke last week stating that if his future at Chelsea depended on winning this final, he should quit now? Gab, what do you make of those comments, and how defining a match is this for Sarri?
I think he's stating the absolute obvious. And, you know, I almost find it funny. I don't know, I'm going to go and blame the media, or especially all those talking head ex-pros in the media. Not Gregor. But if you judge somebody's future on a single match, then you're not doing your job as a club. There's many different ways that you can win a game or lose a game. If you think somebody should replace Sarri as Chelsea manager, then this should make no difference whatsoever, a single game. He's obviously been heavily linked to Juventus, which would be absolutely extraordinary in terms of the departure for Juventus from how they've operated before, and Sarri's own history as a former Napoli manager. I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it, if it happens. But, I mean, I think he's already ticked the boxes that he needed to tick for this year. He hit his objectives. They finished third in the table. They reached two finals. They lost one on penalties while playing really, really well, I thought, against Manchester City, who were the best team in England. And there's going to be presumably some big upheaval at Chelsea over the summer. And he's somebody who generally works with what he has at his disposal. You know, he's not the most pragmatic. He thinks he can go and he can teach his football and turn Ross Barkley into Marek Hamsik and whatever else. So to me, it wouldn't make any sense for Chelsea to sack him. From his perspective, if the Juventus offer is real, if they're willing to go and pay Chelsea compensation and take him, then obviously you think about it. All right, that's all we've got time for today on our bumper UEFA competition final podcast. Many, many thanks to our excellent guest today. It's a pleasure to have in the studio James Gierbrandt and Gregor Robertson, and also down the line, Ollie Kay on his way to Baku and Paul Joyce in beautiful downtown Ormskirk.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information.
And I'm going to be back next Monday with reaction to that Champions League final.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.